Welcome everyone. I'd like to introduce to you our speaker for this session, Professor Susan Webb, who is a Professor of Education at Monash University. Sue's field of research is in policy sociology and understanding the impact of policy on education and lifelong learning with a focus on social inclusion. She has worked in both the UK and Australia, conducting research on widening access and participation to higher education for students from non-traditional backgrounds. Sue's presentation today, Skilled Migrants and Their Families, A Brain Gain or Brain Waste, explores the pathways to employment for Australia's skilled migrants and their families. In particular, this research considers the complexity of transitions for skilled female migrants. Now I'd like to hand over to Susan.
Thank you. A bit of a switch to suddenly move from young people and thinking about young people in Australia and their aspirations, which a number of the other presentations have been about and I was talking about earlier, to focusing on one particular segment of the Australian population, which is that is skilled migrants, which I am one, having come here just over 3 years ago. And one of the things that I want to draw on is particularly kind of the issue of the sort of the economics of migration and the work that's gone on around the concept of brain gain, brain loss, brain circulation, and so on. And so I'm talking about this in using that kind of heading for this presentation, because I think we've got some questions really to ask about skilled migration and their families here in Australia, about whether it's a brain gain or a brain waste. I'm going to say a little bit about migration in Australia. For many of you, this will perhaps be quite familiar territory. So I'll go through that relatively quickly, just a few figures on that. I'll say a bit more about the implications of policies to do with migration and policies to do with education, and to the extent to which education and migration policies connect or don't connect. And then explain the rationale for the particular piece of research that was conducted and funded by NCVR, and then draw attention to the findings and some concluding thoughts. So migration flows. You'll be familiar with this, I'm sure, that since the mid-1990s, there's been a shift to focus on skilled migration into Australia. It's discretionary. It's at the discretion of the Australian government whether or not people are allowed to come to Australia with their skills. It's predicated on the idea that Australia will need people to come because of particular skill shortages, especially outside capital cities. The sending regions have been changing. The largest sending regions now are in fact regions within Asia, Northeast Asia, Southern Asia. Europe is still part of one of the major sending regions, but its role has lessened considerably. And then the kind of wider Oceania is also still quite significant. Interestingly, compared with the rest of the world, it shares parallels with places like Canada, but net migration hasn't slowed down since the global financial crisis in 2008. But of course, when we talk about migration, there are different kinds of migrations, and there is an increased public fear of boat people. But the most recent census data talks about 26% of Australians were born overseas. And I won't say any more really about boat people. But I think we just have to put the two things together, and we do have to think about the two faces of migration. The campaign that was being run in the media before the last election. And on the right-hand side, I should have actually tried to find a photograph of a beautiful beach, but you know, the right-hand side, the terminology there, the language there, is all part of the sort of language that migration agents use advertising in other countries, particularly in Europe, UK, Ireland, to see whether people would want to come to Australia. So the focus is all about, are you on the skilled occupation list, the discretionary aspect, but then a second major part, it's all about coming and living in Australia because of the beautiful beaches, the good climate. Of course, I didn't realise quite what Melbourne's climate was like when I came here. Anyway, so migration policy logic. Well, the logic is all about brain gain. Yeah, we need them. We need people. It's, as Phillips and Spinks say, to fill gaps in the labour market where they currently exist. So it's a managed migration to benefit the economy. Migrants fit job demands. It's about perceived skills shortage. It's about valuing people's human capital, valuing individual people's brains. Whereas towards asylum seekers, it's about residual obligations. So there's a real tension, I think, still with some of the things playing out around that, with perhaps some of the, now this is very much me coming in as an outsider, but some of what I've read about the pre-70s kind of policies around white Australia. So you have some real tensions around multiculturalism in the 21st century. Education policy, well, what does that look like? Well, it's also about brain gain. We need more brains. Education problems and solutions focus on the economy. Skills shortages increase the proportion of the population with undergraduate qualifications, increase the proportion with foundational skills. Problems around participation in the workforce, not enough people participating in the workforce compared with other OECD countries, an unrealised workforce potential. There are more people who are underemployed. And targets around low socioeconomic status, people from low socioeconomic status neighbourhoods, and trying to increase the participation of people from those neighbourhoods into higher education, and also those from regional remote areas and Indigenous people. But migration, the experience. Well, this is very much now from, not from our research, this is from literature and from census data. Skilled migrants actually lift the educational level of states. Something that was pointed out in a presentation earlier by Chandra Shah from a seat at Monash University with whom I work, that the sense of aspiration is often there with skilled migrants. Skilled migrants are more likely to be unemployed, though, or inappropriately employed, according to census data. And skilled migrants, we're talking about brain waste as if it's one person's brain, but skilled migration is often a family affair. It's not necessarily something that individuals do on their own. They often come as part of a family or a household. Over a third of the skilled migrant secondary applicants, these are the partners who come with skilled migrants, had not worked since arrival, according to census data. But skilled migrants are much more motivated to move interstate than the population as a whole. So you've got a set of people with the brain gain that the country wants. They're willing to move. They're encouraging and lifting the educational level of states, but they're often underemployed, and particularly their partners are often underemployed. So the issue is this a gain or is it a waste? Well, looking at the education logic and the migrants' experience, social inclusion is defined as not having a tertiary education qualification. That's the human capital to obtain high-level skilled employment and the economic benefits. Many of these skilled migrants and their partners are seen to be socially included because they've already got tertiary qualifications. So immediately, in terms of the education logic, they only have access to funded tertiary education if they come in as an international student and have then taken the visa route into permanent residency. As an international student, they're paying international student fees, so they're not getting funded support. Once they have permanent residency and study a lower level qualification, they would be able to have some funding for tertiary education. Or humanitarian refugee settlers can also access the Adult Migrant English Programme. And that programme would regard full participation as something that is wanted. But the message here is you come in with your brain, it's a gain, therefore you don't need to be further supported. But the experiences of underemployment. So our research was focused on this aspect of what we regarded as a potentially area of social exclusion within the education and training sector. And we wanted to try and understand, well, how does this come about? What are the experiences of secondary skilled migrants, especially women, in settling and obtaining employment? And how can education and training contribute towards more socially inclusive outcomes for migrant women and their families? We used a qualitative case study approach. We focused in on one area. In some ways, this is not generalizable, but in other ways, it's quite typical of a regional area that's not particularly growing, that economically it's facing a number of problems of restructuring because of the types of employment there. But interestingly, migrants form an important part of certain workforces in this regional area. So the population is growing slightly at about just over 1% a year, and migrants and humanitarian settlers are an important part of this population. We conducted interviews with skilled migrants, predominantly women, because you're interested in women who are predominantly the skilled part, the partners of skilled migrants. But we also included some male secondary migrants, and we included some male primary migrants who had partners who were skilled as well. We also talked to people from various organisations working with migrants, education organisations, employers, departments and agencies in this particular area, non-governmental organisations and community and religious groups. And it was in Victoria. It was there, in Shepparton, a population of about 60,000, an area that's been in the news recently with the threat of kind of closure of the major canning industry there, which has now actually been kind of saved for the present. So policy logics. A local employer talked of the need for skilled migrants. Talking about the area, he regarded it as an area with the lowest participation rates in tertiary education, lowest completion of year 12, year 11, year 10. So it's an area, he said, it has a very high dependency on Centrelink payments. Pretty much every sort of little KPI were either the worst of the worst. So aspirations just need to improve. It hadn't been an issue up to then because there'd been an abundance of low-skilled work, but it's not increasing. So we still need to pick the fruit, but there's probably less of that. We still need people to work in the cannery, but they're moving to more automated stuff. The business is winding down anyway. So the jobs that are going to exist in this area, if this area is to continue to be a vibrant area, and I would argue that that is probably true of many regional areas that did not experience the particular boom associated with mining and quarrying, or experiencing the kind of boom associated with being a kind of coastal life change retirement kind of place, that many regional areas do need to think about the kinds of industries and the sort of level of innovation that might be needed in those areas. So skilled migrants, as this managing director saw it, that skilled migrants can raise that skill level. They can help develop the economy of the region, and they can help raise aspirations in education. They are going to be many of the people who can help shift and lift areas as well as contributing to them. But the skilled migrants come in with these and experience these unintended consequences of policy. They have to manage themselves. Skilled migrants must create their own social networks to support their migration. As this woman said, Shalina, I don't think for skilled migrants there are many support services. For refugee migrants, we have many agencies working for them. But I don't know whether they have the assumption in their mind that skilled migrants will manage themselves. So migrants, skilled migrants that is, have to take individual responsibility for their own transition. But I would want to argue that in fact class, gender, race all impact on the kind of network participation that they can develop within Australia, and that these things affect their ability to manage themselves in a way that will ensure that there's a brain gain. But for some skilled migrants, there was clearly a brain gain. Those migrants who maintained their professional networks in their transition, they experienced what we argue is a normal career transition. That meant they had to keep those networks up. They had hot knowledge then for job searching, or they actually had employer sponsorship as they arrived in Australia. So for those people, as I've quote at the bottom of the slide here, they're using what back in the 1970s Grenevita called weak ties. These are not the tight ties, the strong ties of family and friends, but they seem weak. But because they're tying people into the sort of powerful networks, they actually end up being powerful. I arrived in Australia with no family. I only knew a couple of people. I had some email addresses. I had met a few of the people I was going to work with in conferences in Europe, and that was it. And now I'm a well-established professional working in my sector, because I was able to maintain those professional networks, maintain a normal career transition. So it's a brain gain. So here are some quotes here from people who for whom the transition was quite normal. Vignac, he was a primary applicant. He worked as an engineer. He'd come from India. There's no difference for me. I get in the car and I come to work. He obtained his job whilst he was overseas. He obtained it in an area that he'd worked in before, and he's continued to participate in the engineers' networks of professional knowledge about the particular field that he worked in. Roshan, she was a secondary applicant, but her husband was moving to a clinical medical role in the local hospital. So she had some support indirectly through that. The employer assistance for the family enabled some of the immediate transition to be a lot easier. The hospital gave us a house, it was furnished, so you didn't need to worry about those, we just settled in. And Vignac again, talking about the previous manager of the company where he worked, and the help that person was able to give. I should say a lot of the help and so on was often not built into systematic policies within these companies, but often relied on individuals who felt the need to go to take the steps to help people settle. But if you disrupt your professional networks, and of course one of the visa routes is the General Skilled Migration Scheme, whereby you simply enter Australia under a points system because you have the particular qualifications in the particular skills shortage areas, but you don't have a particular job to go to. If you disrupt your professional networks, and of course the secondary migrants have normally had to disrupt their professional networks because they're not the ones who are coming for a particular job, You give up your employment as you enter Australia. You have no employment. You don't have even these weak ties to other employers. You often perhaps have gone through quite extensive and lengthy entry processes. You might lack the strong ties of your family and the support that that can give you. And if you're a female secondary migrant and you have children and you haven't got those support networks, how are you going to cope with looking after family and so on? Then you hit another barrier. Your skills and qualifications and experiences will seldom be accepted by Australian employers. So you have a conundrum. They were accepted under the point system for entry, but they don't actually carry much currency when it comes to applying for a job. And yet you've got pressure to be financially independent because you don't get state support for the first 2 years. So very risky trajectories, career disruption, and often brain waste. So here are some examples of this. Arunchal, she's a secondary applicant. She talked about how we both came on skilled migration visas, thinking we'd get jobs in our area. He was going to low-level jobs because obviously he had a wife and child to feed. Some of these applicants, they had worked in the tertiary education sector. Some had PhDs. We had biochemists. We had a whole range of people with wide-ranging experiences. The biggest problem, Satwinder said, is when you come here, they do need experience, and the experience you have is from overseas, but it's not probably considered as important or relevant to here. Fauzia, I worked at a lot of odd jobs. I worked at Safeway for 3 months. My husband was working as a handyman. We're both doctors, but the jobs don't come to you on a plate. So what's the role of vet? Well, qualifications are not necessarily always recognised to work in Australia, as I say. What I'm going to do here is just talk through two slides just to illustrate the role of vet. This one comes from a typical male secondary migrant. We only actually interviewed three secondary migrants who were male. James. James was from Nigeria. He'd qualified in Nigeria, he'd worked in South Africa, he had an MBA from China. But the qualifications weren't recognised for practice here. So he couldn't work as an accountant, which is what he'd done before. His partner was a radiographer, and she was on a temporary visa in the local hospital. She was on a temporary visa, he was on a temporary visa, so he couldn't afford to go to the university to re-qualify as an accountant, to do the further qualification that was needed here to get his accountancy qualification recognised. It was a conversion course. So we have a brain waste. But he needed to get a job. They couldn't survive on just his wife's wage. So he needed to re-qualify to get a job, because the only work available that he could get was in aged care. But to do aged care, he needed a specific qualification, a Cert 3 in aged care. So he did this. He didn't do it at the local TAFE. That was too expensive and too long. He found a quick and cheaper provider in Melbourne. So he travelled to Melbourne one day a week for a short period of time, as a quick way of qualifying to then carry on working in the sector. So what he's now doing is he's now managed to get permanent residency, and he is now doing his conversion course. But I'm suggesting, and this I think is a politically charged kind of way of describing it, but I think in some ways it's an objective way of describing it. The role of that in providing routes into current labour force activity and providing qualifications only at that level, rather than looking at the holistic picture of who the person is and where they might be able to go and what they might be able to offer, has ironically contributed to a form of de-skilling, a form of brain waste. He, of course, is going to try and move out of that position, but in the short term, it's a form of de-skilling. Now, this woman, Damayanti, similar, qualifications and experience not recognised, degree in business admin from a Belgian university, postgraduate diploma in journalism from Colombo University. She'd worked in social and media research in Sri Lanka. But no job. For women, it was often more an experience of intensified domestication if they had children. And many of these women had children, because they had no family to support them. She moves out of this through volunteering. Quite happenstance in some respects. The person who led the adult migrant English skills program in the local TAFE was herself somebody who'd come in through these kinds of routes and acted as a sponsor, a champion, a mentor to many others that she came across in quite serendipitous ways. What this meant was that this woman ended up reducing her employment expectations to get Australian experience. She gained part-time work in community work. She's now a project manager in a local NGO. But she had to, in order to do that, she also did have to re-qualify, but at a lower level, again through the TAFE. She couldn't do this work, she couldn't practice this work without a TAFE Cert 4 in training and assessment. But the fees were very high, and she was still on a temporary visa. So whilst she might have and had an ambition to do a higher level qualification in education and gain her diploma in education, at that point she couldn't afford to do that. She now has permanent residency and she's now considering doing that, but she's not there yet. So for her, it's been a much longer journey. A similar process in a sense of de-skilling, importance of the voluntary sector, and very much a more feminised kind of route. So, findings. I think skilled migrants' access to education and training is obviously limited by visa type. That's an obvious finding. But the vocational education and training sector is often not seen relevant to many migrants because they're coming in already with higher level qualifications. And the TAFEs do not, and RTOs do not necessarily see skilled migrants as the target group. Yet, they're actually there in relatively large numbers on certain kinds of programs, but they're not there moving on as part of a brain gain. They're using the system simply to qualify for particular forms of work because they need to be employed. So in re-qualifying, they're often de-skilling, and they're often moving into quite gendered, lower skilled work in the human services, child and aged care sector. And because of that pressure of financial need, they often move into the private vet sector as opposed to the public vet sector. But they do engage in a lot of learning, but it's often informal learning, lifelong learning, and through volunteering. And ironically, they become the key workers who begin to then work with other vulnerable, disadvantaged people and humanitarian migrants. And quite often pioneer migrants who are working on those kinds of programs help people further into getting into this area of work. So the social networking that people are involved in, beyond their immediate family ties, does give them access to new employment networks. And some experiences we found from some who had been at some universities did build their employability skills and their understanding of labour markets in Australia. But the Australian experience is important, it counts. The first reference is important. Getting into a pathway to employment does require professional capital, networks, it requires that social capital. And the modes of entry will often disrupt this. A clear finding is the race and ethnicity discrimination was much greater for visible migrants. And I'll kind of leave you, I think, with this kind of sense, because we did have a range of migrants that reflected the wide range of regions that migrants come from in this particular area of regional Australia. And to a large extent, I think that, that race and ethnic difference was held up, as did if you came in young from a European or Anglo background without children, you are more likely to be able to find a route into professional employment more quickly. But you had to involve yourself in the sort of social networks that were more closely aligned with the more powerful professional networks in the regional area, which were by and large fairly Anglo-European. So you had to do this. You had to, I just move on to the last point because I want to finish. You had to do what this woman did. She played netball, which she didn't really like, but she did it purely for the social inclusion. Now she's included, I don't need to play anymore. She has a very high-powered job in the region now. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.